Our next guest on Midday is historian Hampton Sides. He takes us back to the late 19th century for the story of the USS Jeannette, captained by a young naval officer named George Washington DeLong, and financed by a wealthy newspaper publisher. The Jeannette sailed in 1879 to find a warm water path across the North Pole that could revolutionize shipping from Europe to Asia. Despite the best equipment and technology, the Jeannette became icebound for 2 years. When the ship was finally destroyed, the crew set off in small boats and ultimately on foot through the most frightful landscape imaginable. Hampton sides with the thrilling and ultimately heartbreaking story of the USS Jeannette on Midday after the news. In the late 19th century, explorers of the Victorian age fixed their gaze on the ends of the Earth, the North and South Poles. In the Northern Hemisphere, one reason was economic, the belief that somewhere in the Arctic ice pack, there was a passage across the American continent that could slash the time and expense of shipping goods between Europe and Asia. Welcome to the second hour of Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Dozens of expeditions came to grief looking for the elusive Northwest Passage. But by the 1870s, a respected German geographer named August Petermann was convinced there was a warm water channel under the North Pole beneath a thin crust of ice that could be broken by stout ships entering through the Bering Strait. And so begins the harrowing adventure of the USS Jeannette. She was a rugged, three-masted steam sailor, financed by James Gordon Bennett, the colorful owner and profitable owner of the New York Herald. At her helm was a young Navy officer, George Washington DeLong, who had already become an Arctic hero. DeLong set sail in 1879 with 32 of the very best men and very best equipment and provisions the 19th century could offer. But nothing could overcome the hard fact that the passage they sought was a figment of the imagination. Soon the Jeannette was locked solid in the Arctic ice, 1,000 miles from the nearest settlement, and there she lay for 2 years as her crew did its best to keep themselves warm and occupied. Hampton Sides makes their story an exciting and ultimately heartbreaking tale of adventure, based on painstaking research into recollections, memoirs, and records. Hampton Sides is an historian, a best-selling author, whose popular narratives include Hellbound on His Trail, the story of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Ghost Soldiers, about the daring rescue of U.S. servicemen from the Bataan Death March during World War II, and Blood and Thunder, a biography of frontiersman Kit Carson. Hampton Sides is editor-at-large for Outside Magazine and has written for National Geographic, The New Yorker, Esquire, Men's Journal, The Washington Post, and other publications. His latest book about this daring but ill-fated expedition in 1879 to find the elusive Northwest Passage is called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. It's available from Doubleday. And we're delighted that Hampton Sides is on our show today on the Midday program here at WYPR in Baltimore. So, Hampton Sides, welcome aboard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you.
Nice to have you with us. It's a great nonfiction narrative that reads with the power of a novel. And it's just a really well done history here. But I wonder what got you to it. Frankly, I'd never heard of the USS Jeannette. I mean, I'm aware of the era of polar expedition in the late 19th century, early 20th century. But what got you to this story?
Yeah, I mean, it really is kind of one of those stories that seems to have fallen between the cracks of history. It was extremely well known in its day. It was these guys were household names. This was a national endeavor, a U.S. Navy expedition, but also funded by a well-known newspaper publisher. Everybody knew about the Jeannette. Very consequential expedition, but it's completely forgotten today. And that's really the reason I wrote this book. When I first found out about it, while on an assignment for National Geographic in Oslo, and I was at a museum that referenced the Jeanette repeatedly, as if I was supposed to know what it was. And me, being an American expedition, an American commander, and I'd never heard of it, I filed that away, came home, and started digging into the literature, and realized that, first of all, for the stories that I do, it's really important that the characters be interesting and that there be a lot of primary documents. And there was a huge amount of stuff to work with. And, you know, I guess historians are constantly, certainly I am, you know, trying to find stories that are forgotten. And there are not many of them left.
Right.
Usually, you know, your alternative is to write another, yet another book about Lincoln.
Yeah.
Trying to find some obscure or unusual angle on a topic that's well known. But in this case, it was like resurrecting a ghost story. You know, something that was hugely well known in its time, but had been forgotten. And I just had a ball doing this book, traveling all over the world, going to Siberia, going to the high Arctic, and trying to understand what this expedition was all about.
I was looking at some drawings or etchings from this expedition and others, and also, Hampton, some photographs. I was drawn to the photograph of Matthew Henson, who was the right-hand man to Admiral Perry, for their expeditions, and looking at those men in their and the clothing that they had to wear for these conditions, I got the sense of astronauts for a moment. You know, you and I grew up in the age of the astronauts and the effort to get to the moon, and this is sort of similar for its time, was it not?
Well, it was similar in a lot of ways. One is that truly no one knew what was up there, and no one knew. In fact, in that sense, it's even more obscure than the moon because scientists had a pretty good idea when we sent men to the moon what was up there and what they would find in terms of conditions. But these guys, I mean, there were so many theories swirling around the North Pole and the South Pole. I get into that in the early parts of the book where I just want to try to understand why it was such a nagging, gnawing obsession with so many people to know what was at the top of the world. And some of the ludicrous theories, of course, I mean, there was people who theorized that there were people up there, a civilization, a lost civilization, or perhaps species that had gone extinct elsewhere. But one of the leading theories was this notion of an open polar sea, that the warm water currents of the ocean, like the Gulf Stream, kept going north, which it in fact does, and that it tunneled under the ice and met at the North Pole and warmed this area of the top of the world. That also, this is a theory that went back to the Vikings and the Greeks. Once you get an idea like stuck in the public imagination over a long period of time, it becomes really hard to dislodge it. And I guess you could say that the voyage of the USS Jeanette was the very last attempt to really prove the existence of this obviously fictitious body of water that's supposed to be at the top of the world.
Could we just mention Sir John Franklin here for a moment of the Royal Navy? Mm-hmm. This goes back even earlier than the period you wrote about, 1845, an expedition there, I guess also based on the same belief that there was such a passage, a way to get through, maybe even that at some point salt water wouldn't freeze.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been many expeditions. That was probably the best known of the British expeditions, because Franklin himself was so well known, and so many men went on that expedition. They were looking truly for a northwest passage. In other words, a way through the archipelago of islands north of Canada, and that they were just obviously not successful. They were never heard from again, and it became one of the great mysteries of Arctic exploration. And many expeditions followed, really not necessarily doing anything but looking for any kind of tidings of what happened to Franklin and his expedition. With my expedition, it's a good bit later, and it's the very first time that they're trying really not so much to find a northwest passage as to find a northern passage. In other words, go due north. And also, while they're at it, try to bag this much more kind of abstract goal, which was to find out what was there mm-hmm. at the North Pole. It might have commercial implications, and it might just be more of a kind of an act of pure exploration that would win some glory for the United States and for the U.S. Navy and for the captain of the ship, George DeLong. It's really important also to understand the context of this expedition, which was the Americans had a bit of chip on their shoulder. The real forerunners in Arctic exploration at this time were the Brits and to a lesser extent the Scandinavian nations. The United States was emerging from the devastation of the Civil War and was beginning to kind of flex its muscles on the world stage and try to do something big, something ambitious. We had also fairly recently purchased Alaska from the Russians. So there was a great curiosity about what was north of the Bering Strait, north of our new territory. So all those factors played into this. There was also some other goals of this expedition, including an island that had been glimpsed by Arctic whalers. It's called Wrangel Island, but was widely believed to be a much bigger landmass, possibly a continent up there. So that was certainly one of the goals of the expedition as well, find out what this Wrangel Island was about.
Amazing.
So
I mean,
you know,
they really didn't know, did they? They really didn't
know. They really didn't know. And, you know, it's easy for us now to knowing what we know now, which is that there's not really anything up there. It's a shifting carapace of ice. There is no civilization. There are no warm water currents. There's no warm water, open polar sea. There are no major land masses. There are a number of islands. It's easy for us to say, well, how ludicrous for them to risk so much for such a tenuous goal when we know what is or what isn't up there.
Now, we have to talk about Gordon Bennett because he's the one that got this thing rolling, and then more on George DeLong. But first, a little bit on Gordon Bennett, a really interesting character. And my question would be, you know, what made him think that this expedition could succeed where others had failed? But Gordon Bennett first.
Gordon Bennett is the guy who underwrote this expedition. He's a flamboyant, Gilded Age, spoiled brat, a brilliant in his own way newspaper editor, but just a great, unbelievable character in his own right. If you were to write this as a novel, I think people would think that this is over the top. You can't have a character like that. But you can, or you did, back in the Gilded Age. Just some little things about him. He was the third richest man in Manhattan. He was a publisher of the New York Herald, which was the largest newspaper in the world at that time. And his paper was very interesting. It was full of news, but also full of a lot of spectacle and adventure stories, sports stories. He was really interested in competitive sports. He brought tennis to the United States. He brought polo to the United States. He himself was a great sailor, and he won the first transatlantic yacht race. He was the youngest ever commodore of the New York Yacht Club. He was into international balloon racing, and he was a speed walker, which
speed walker.
Is really bizarre.
Yeah.
Yes, a
yeah.
speed walker. He publicly urinated into a grand piano at a salon at a very swanky place in New York, and got himself sort of ostracized from New York society. He moved to Paris, where he ran the New York Herald via the transatlantic cables from Paris, and then started his own paper there in Paris, which became ultimately the International Herald Tribune, which mm-hmm. is the kind of the last vestige of his empire. Hmm. But anyway, a great character. He was famous, probably most famous, for having sent Stanley to find Livingston in Africa, and had enjoyed such an enormous success with the dispatches that Stanley sent back from Africa that he was looking kind of for an encore story, some kind of big, ambitious exploration that would sell newspapers.
Hampton, I love this part of the story because it's the newspaper part of it. A newspaper should not merely report stories, it should create them. And that you just mentioned Stanley and Livingston. You know, there was no evidence really that Livingston was lost or even that he wanted to be found, right?
Right, right. You know, Livingston, I presume. And Livingston was a little bit miffed at first, like, why are you here? I'm doing just fine. But it made a great story. And in fact, it did break some news. And it certainly deepened our understanding of the interior of the African continent. And, you know, there was a synergy, an interesting synergy between newspapers and exploration. Almost every expedition had at least some sponsorship from a newspaper or certainly a newspaper correspondent on board. And, you know, this continues today with exploration, except it tends to more be documentaries and television crews and, you know, National Geographic kind of funded expeditions. But the role, the very interesting kind of synergistic role between of media enhancing expeditions of exploration goes way back.
So we'll stop here and take a little break and come back to Gordon Bennett and his next big story, the adventure of the that leads to the adventure of the USS Jeannette with Captain George DeLong. We're speaking with Hampton Sides about his latest book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. This is Midday. A short break. We'll be right back. Yes, and Dan Roderick's here with Hampton Sides, author of In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette, available from Doubleday. It's the story of the captain and crew of the USS Jeannette, which was equipped with the best supplies, technology, and instruments money could buy in 1879 when it set out on a voyage to prove there was an open sea path across the North Pole. So we mentioned the founder of the feast, Mr. Bennett, James Gordon Bennett, Jr., the publisher of the New York Herald. And now let's talk a little bit about George DeLong, the captain. Tell us a little bit about him. He was already something of an Arctic hero, right?
He was. He had been to Greenland on an earlier expedition and had acquitted himself very, very well there and had been kind of become a star in the newspapers and had become somewhat infected by, you know, this the Arctic virus, the polar fever. It seems to be the kind of place that you either love it or you hate it. And he fell deeply in love with it. You know, the sounds and the atmospheric phenomena and this great puzzle, this enormous planetary enigma of what was up there, how did it all work? And he vowed that after leaving Greenland, that he would be the first man to reach the North Pole, and he would do it for personal glory, sure, but also for his Navy. He was a career officer and had just missed the Civil War by a matter of months when he graduated from the Naval Academy, which was actually during the Civil War, was not in Annapolis. You know, they moved it up to Newport during the Civil War to keep it a little bit farther away from the Confederates. But when he graduated, you know, he had just missed the Civil War and had, I think, a little bit of a kind of a sense that his brothers and, you know, cousins and all of his, you know, all the men in his life had all participated in this great and momentous event, the Civil War, which he had missed. And I think, yeah, he was touched with a peculiar kind of ambition to do something equally grand, equally large on a world stage, and that's where he hatched this desire, really, to be the first man to reach the North Pole.
Okay, so George, my question was going to be: George DeLong did not feel he was being sucked into a publicity stunt. He liked this. He wanted to do it.
No. I mean, I think you could say that he was quite wary of Bennett. He understood that the Navy at that time was extremely weak, certainly when it came to money. There was no money for this sort of thing. There was ambition, but there was not money. And this kind of what we now think of as being a very unusual and very unorthodox relationship between the Navy and a media outlet was not considered so unusual back then. I guess today you would compare it to what? Like Ted Turner decides to fund an expedition to Mars with NASA. Just wouldn't happen. But back then, given the state of the Navy, the very anemic state of the Navy after the Civil War, it made more sense than it sounds. But the other thing is Gordon Bennett, you know, read a lot about the Arctic and had a lot of theories of his own and actually dabbled with the idea that he might himself come on board the ship and explore the North with DeLong. DeLong read for 5 years, planned this thing thoroughly, and at the same time, you know, kept his arm's length from Bennett. He Bennett's a crazy cat. I mean, this is almost like, you know, completely opposite kind of personality from DeLong. It's probably a good thing that Bennett didn't come on board the ship because I'm sure they would have ended up tangling with each other.
Let's talk about the ship a little bit.
Sure.
The USS Jeannette. It's called USS. Was it a naval ship, per se?
Well, it was originally a British gunship, three-masted. It was, you know, both a sailing vessel, but it also was a steamer. And not very large, large enough to accommodate about 30 to 35 men. It had been reinforced for the ice by the British and had done quite well on several expeditions in and around Greenland. When Bennett purchased it, he renamed it the Jeannette. It had been known prior to that as the Pandora, which is kind of an ominous name. He named it, Bennett did, after his sister Jeannette, and it then was sailed around the Horn to San Francisco, where Navy engineers massively reinforced the ship for ice and practically rebuilt it. And because they knew, even though there was this belief in an open polar sea, they certainly knew that they were going to encounter a lot of ice and enormous pressures on the hull. So it was enormous amount of money and time and effort was spent rebuilding the ship for the ice.
Okay. Now, I mentioned August Petermann in the beginning when I introduced you, Hampton. We should talk about him a little bit. He was a German geographer who did have a part in this.
Absolutely. He was probably at that time the foremost cartographer in the world and had an operation based in a little village in Germany called Gotha, Germany, where he published atlases and maps, the most up-to-date, beautiful, hand-colored maps in the world. They were kind of the Google Earth maps of their day, very detailed, very meticulous. And he had this interesting relationship with explorers, which is like whenever an exploration party came back from someplace like the interior of Australia or something like that, they would meet with him in Gotha and they would go over what they found and he would begin to fill in the last gaps of the world, the few places left where man had never been before. He was fascinated by those places, the interior of Africa, Australia, the Himalayas, a few other places, and of course, the North and South Pole. And so he pontificated particularly on the Arctic. He was a great enthusiast. And although he was an amazing map maker and truly one of the most important, innovators in the art and science of map making, he was completely dead wrong on all of his theories about what was at the North Pole. He was a big believer in the open polar sea. Something he called the thermometric gateway that would lead to that open polar sea. He had a lot of wacky ideas. And unfortunately, a good number of expeditions were launched based on his ideas that led to misery and ruin and in some cases death. And the Jeannette was the next one in line.
Thermometric gateway, meaning like a warm water channel because he believed it was there, not based on any science or evidence.
Well, no, it's not that, like the Gulf Stream. We know that it goes north. Mm-hmm. We know that it carries tremendous thermal power. It frays as it goes north, and it was not well known where it went. And his theory was that it keeps going, and it tunnels under the ice, making that particular stretch of ice slushy and weak, and it ultimately leads to the North Pole. On the Pacific side, there's another massive current that does exist called the Kuro Siwo, which means black current in Japanese. It does go north as well. The theory was it must go through the Bering Strait and keep on going. But Petermann's idea was this beautiful symmetrical notion that these two great currents kept going north and met at the North Pole, and that it was part of this great kind of thermal regulation system of the planet, that the planet, you know, had this beautiful kind of, like an organism has a circulatory system, mm-hmm. that the Earth must have its own for regulating heat. Obviously wrong. Sounds great. It's a beautiful idea, rather grandiose, but completely, as it turns out, completely wrong.
Hampton Sides is our guest in this hour of Midday. His latest book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. It's 1879. They're going to start out from San Francisco. And it would be helpful, Hampton, if you could just chart out what they believed was going to be their course.
Yes. Well, the idea was to leave in the summer of 79, head north through the Bering Strait, pick up some supplies in Alaska, and try to get up there ahead of the ice, you know, get as far north as possible before they encountered ice. They had some delays, unfortunately, along the way that set them back. And by the time they got north of the Bering Strait, north of Alaska, they encountered ice fairly quickly. And in September, became locked fast in the ice not far from a place called Wrangell Island. And, you know, it's not that they weren't prepared for the ice. They just thought it would happen a little later and a little less intensely, because this ice was like a vice grip, and it nearly sank the ship early on. But thankfully, all that reinforcing that had been going on in San Francisco paid off. They did withstand the pressure of the ice for 2 years, and the ship it was locked in the ice, but it was moving because the ice is constantly moving. They were generally moving about a mile a day towards the northwest, and they remained in the ice for 2 years as they kind of gradually made their way towards the North Pole. At a certain point, DeLong was giving up on the idea of an open polar sea, but he did believe that there was a possibility that they could drift in the ice pack to the North Pole, or get at least very close. So
he
that
kept,
was his kind
he,
of.
This is amazing to me to think about 2 years at this. Did they have a prediction on how long it would take them to actually carry out their mission if they were successful?
Not exactly. They had enough food for 3 years in the hold of the ship. You know, in terms of dried food, pemmican, canned goods. They also replenished that constantly by hunting. They proved to be very good hunters. They killed a lot of walrus and seal and polar bear. They didn't starve during that two-year period at all. They had plenty of food. They had a great library. They had musical instruments, a little theater, a little printing press. They had big parties around the holidays. They had Edison's lights on board, although they didn't work. they had telephones from Alexander Graham Bell, so they could communicate over large stretches of the ice. You know, they weren't exactly suffering during those 2 years. They were slowly kind of going mad from boredom and being helpless in a sense. They were subject to the whims of the prevailing currents of the prevailing winds. After 2 years. In the summer of 1881, finally the enormous pressure of the ice pack crushed the hull of the ship, and they had just a few hours to get their belongings out before the ship sank to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. And so you had 33 men and their 40 dogs and three small open boats out on the ice with just very few belongings. And really, in some ways, that's where the story begins. At least that's where the ordeal begins.
All right.
Because they realize they just have a few months to get through the summer and get to the nearest landmass, which is about 1,000 miles away, and it's the central Arctic coast of Siberia, a very forbidding place in and of itself. So this begins kind of what I think of as really being one of the great survival stories, one of the great stories of leadership and comradeship of all time, as these men pull together to try to save themselves during the summer of 1881.
Hampton, we're going to take a break here and come back and talk about some of the rest of the story. We won't give it all away here on Midday, but and a couple more questions also about that two-year period before we get to the next part of this adventure. And we'll do that Great. After this break. Hampton Sides, our guest, his book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Voyage of the USS Jeannette, Arctic Expedition of 1879-1881. A short break. We'll be right back. The story of the USS Jeannette, Hampton Sides' book, In the Kingdom of Ice. So, Hampton, before we get into the next part of the adventure, just a little bit more on those 2 years. I'm just kind of amazed to think of this ship, a three-masted steamer sailing ship stuck in the ice for pretty much for 2 years. Now, was Captain DeLong thinking, well, you know, as the wind shifts or as the current shifts, maybe the ice will break off a little bit, we can keep moving northward? Is that what he did or was hoping for during that time?
I think he was hoping that they would, at least during the summertime, break free of the ice and be able to continue their northern journey.
Mm-hmm.
They really, at this point, thought that it would be almost better to keep going north and pop out on the other side, which would be Greenland, than try to head back south through the ice and ultimately reach the Bering Strait again. But really, he was pretty helpless. I mean, there was not anything he could do about it. And that was what was so galling and so frustrating for him, was that they're, you know, you're just subject to these forces that you can't control. And by the way, this ice isn't like this monolithic and, you know, slab of ice. It's constantly shifting and churning and shuddering and shaking and shrieking, making these horrible sounds, the sounds of the ice warring with itself and the sound of the ice warring with the ship. It's alive, and it's quite terrifying as they go through those 2 years. Like I said, they had plenty of food to eat, but they were kind of going slowly mad. And one mm-hmm. of the reasons is there was this character named Collins, the meteorologist, who really interesting character at first. Everyone liked him. But then they found out that he had this penchant for delivering really bad puns. Lots of wordplay. Limericks.
That would drive you crazy on land.
Yeah. Two hours, fine. Maybe even 2 days. But we're talking 2 years of this guy. And by the end of it, everyone is trying to wring this guy's neck.
You know, you say you had a lot of primary source material for this. Memoirs, recollections from some of the crew members. And so did they describe the moment when the ship actually sinks?
Very vividly. Perhaps the best source is Captain DeLong's own account in his journals, you know, where it's just blow by blow, minute by minute. First, the ship breaks free of the ice. It's floating for a time. They think it's going to be fine. Then the ice closes back up again and squeezes it like a vice grip and makes these terrible sounds. And then the ship starts leaking so much. There's no way they can counteract it. So, but DeLong had a very clear plan that they had already rehearsed about which belongings they would get off the ship and how and who would do what. Luckily, they had rehearsed it enough, and they were able to get at least, you know, a lot of their food, a lot of their furs, the dogs, and also the logbooks. Interestingly, all the books, all the journals, all the paperwork of the expedition, which, you know, very big, very cumbersome, very these are folio-sized volumes. And he had to think to himself, is this really necessary? But then he began to treat them like relics, because he said, you know, this is the only proof that this expedition ever existed. And so these volumes went with him everywhere he went as they worked their way south across the ice, across the water, across the tundra of Siberia, and somehow or another ended up in the National Archives in Washington. And when I was looking at them, I just thought, God, what an amazing journey these books took to get to this repository in Washington.
Do you mind if I read a passage from DeLong's journal?
Sure.
It's not very long. This is something he wrote You'll remember this, Hampton. This is from Christmas Day. I'm not sure of the year. It was either 1879 or 1880, right? He says, I'm going to just read this. Christmas morning began black and bleak, the winds howling, the temperatures outside so cold that the contracting bolts and metal fasteners throughout the ship snapped and cracked in their timbers. Overnight, a sleeping dog curled up on the pack, meaning the ice pack, and had become so firmly adhered to the ice that it had to be removed with a shovel. It was impossible to take observations because the lenses of the instruments could not be cleared of frost and vapor. Inside the ship, a green scum of long-accumulated condensation clung to the walls, the ceilings, bulkheads, and nearly every other interior surface. This is the dreariest day I have ever experienced, and it certainly passed in the dreariest part of the world. Wow, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was a fine writer. I think that's another part of it that I discovered to my great, you know, I was very excited to realize what a really great writer he was. And sometimes in writing under horrible conditions, but every day he sat down and very disciplined about it. He got it down on paper. But the other survivors wrote great books. Some of the others who didn't unfortunately make it also had journals which were recovered. There was also a naval inquiry and also a congressional inquiry. So there was a huge amount of testimony, not to mention Bennett, the newspaper publisher, sent his reporters to Siberia and got tons and tons of stories out of this, all of which was great for my, you know, in terms of just almost an embarrassment of really great material to work with in putting this expedition back together.
So once the Jeanette sinks, and all the men survive the sinking of the ship, right? They manage to get off with their dogs.
They do.
Now, they can't just do this on foot because they might come to water again soon. So do they take lifeboats with them?
Yeah, they have three whale boats, tippy wooden boats, quite heavy, which they have to drag over the ice. And so all the men get in harness like a bunch of mules and start hauling both the boats and their belongings, their food, working with alongside the dogs. And this slog over the ice takes 92 days of just excruciating backbreaking work. And DeLong had the whole thing very well organized. He was certainly wary and wary of the possibility of a mutiny, and he was able to hold it together. Along the way, they discovered three islands, one of which they spent some time on and explored. It's now known as Bennett Island, named after the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they finally made it to open water, and began to set sail, only to find out that these three boats, having been battered and dragged across the ice, were not seaworthy. They sank. They would have sank. They would have sunk. And so DeLong and his men had to practically rebuild them using whalebone and walrus tusks and driftwood that they found, and they got them seaworthy again and set sail eventually. In August of 1881 for the Siberian coast.
You know, you're with Outside Magazine, and that magazine very frequently features articles about gear, outside gear, what you're supposed to wear when you go bicycling or mountain biking or hiking or camping. And we've got all this space-age stuff now. You know, we've got all this really cool gear that's lightweight but very warm and comfortable. And I keep looking at these photographs and drawings of the men in this expedition and others of that time. And I'm trying to imagine what's on the inside. I know there's these big fur coats with the big hoods. But did you get a good record in your research of how they kept warm, especially their feet? I'm curious about that.
Yeah. Well, during that slog across the ice, they were never really warm because they were constantly falling in to the water, lagoons and pools of melt water. And, you know, they were wearing fur boots, sealskin boots are usually sealskin underneath fur, and it was constantly wet. And so they were having lots of problems with, you know, foot rot and so forth. The surgeon has in his journals some really, you know, wonderful accounts of some of the maladies they're suffering from. And, of course, later on, as they get deeper into Siberia, they begin to encounter serious frostbite and have to amputate limbs and so forth. But, yeah, I did, as an editor at Outside, I thought about, you know, what these guys could have – how they could have used some of the equipment that we review sometimes. You know, a little Gore-Tex, a couple of GPSs.
Well, sure. I mean
surely would have been nice.
I mean, I've heard you mention the telephones that were kind of useless, but they were from Alexander Graham Bell. They were hoping to use those aboard ship. How would they have used those? How would they have communicated?
Oh, well, the idea was they would – string the wire out over long periods of time, because throughout those 2 years on the ice, they were sending parties out to do various things, take measurements, hunt, explore a little bit. And so it was really just for communication over expanses of ice.
Okay. And then they had arc lamps from Thomas Edison that didn't work.
They didn't work. Now, Edison was just perfecting this, you know, literally within weeks of them entering the ice. Edison back in New Jersey was truly perfecting his light bulb. And, you know, so it's just kind of a near miss kind of thing. If their timing had been different, they would at least would have had light during the total darkness of the Arctic winter. Wouldn't have saved them, but it certainly would have improved their morale and would have been fascinating kind of just to think about, like lighting up the Arctic. You know, they certainly wanted to have all the latest inventions on board, and Bennett was able to pay for them all. But some of them, unfortunately, weren't quite ready for prime time and didn't quite work.
And did Captain DeLong, in his journal in describing this part of the journey, was he able to continue to write in his journal about, you know, after the ship sank?
Yes. I mean, every single day. It's uncanny, actually. I'm just trying to imagine him after hauling this stuff all day, how he's in his tent just trying to get this stuff down, and how quite vivid much of it is. You know, these men were actually, to a surprising degree, quite thrilled by this part of the journey. As hard as it was, they were doing something, you know, to save themselves. And they, as excruciatingly painful as it was, they were working together as a team. And, you know, there's a certain camaraderie that came from all of that. Whereas the 2 years before, they were just stuck in a piece of ice.
Right, right.
And there was a sense of momentum now. They were moving towards home, and they found these islands and did some real exploration and mapped them. So it was kind of a, as hard as it was kind of the high point of the expedition.
Well, I don't want to give everything away here. I respect your narrative and the work you've put into this, but could you give us a taste of just how bad did it get during those, 92 days out there on the ice?
Well, it was horrible during the 92 days, but they did reach open water and rebuilt those boats and set sail, only to encounter a gale, a massive gale. And these were expert sailors. Many of them were naval officers. They knew, even in a small open boat like that, they knew what they were doing. But this was a massive storm, and the first thing it did was it separated the three boats from each other. They wanted to stay together, but they just couldn't, because the boats were different sized and operated differently, and they lost sight of each other. And then they became so separated that they landed hundreds of miles apart from each other in this place called the Lena Delta, which is an enormous river delta. The Lena River is one of the largest rivers in the world. And they landed far apart from each other. And so the story really becomes the separate fates of these three boats and the three groups of men as they make landfall and as they try to find each other, stumbling through this labyrinth of islands, thousands and thousands of islands and back channels, working their way south, trying to also find civilization, trying to find a native village where they would be saved. The last 100 pages, I've been pretty disciplined about just not telling people what happened. I do think it's more meaningful, more moving to not Google. Don't Google this.
Right.
And to see, see how these men, just incredible stoicism and bravery and camaraderie as they work their way south towards civilization, trying to save themselves while also finding each other in this vast wilderness, which I had the opportunity to go to for Outside Magazine. I did a piece about it. Just an extraordinary place, the Lena Delta, and an amazing vast wilderness, which is three times the size of the Florida Everglades, but a frozen Everglades, an amazing place in its own right.
It's just an amazing thing to think about, being out in this unexplored territory, frightful landscape, in these harsh conditions at a time when it's just hard to imagine, you know, a world without telephones, a world without radio. All of that stuff was yet to be, although this was a period of intense scientific discovery and invention in the late 19th, going into the 20th century.
Once they made it through the Lena Delta, and some of them found civilization in the form of a village of there's a tribe there that is speaks a Turkish language, it's just so far from civilization that they are still 2,000 miles away from the nearest telegraph station, which is the city of Irkutsk, which is way down there on Lake Baikal. And so that's how far, you know, even when they're saved, that's how far they are from getting the word out to civilization and to Bennett's newspaper.
Hampton, one of our listeners called in to tell us that there's a large monument at the U.S. Naval Academy Cemetery to the Jeannette, a monument to the Jeannette.
Yeah, I did a good bit of research both at the National Archives in Washington and also at the Naval Academy, which has some of DeLong's relics, some of his papers, some of his wife's papers. There on the Severn River, overlooking the Severn, is the Jeannette Memorial there in the cemetery. And it's a cross with icicles. And when I was on the book tour, a graduate of the Naval Academy told me that when he was a young midshipman, one of the, you know, rituals or hazing rituals that he was required to do was to go run over there. And apparently this was common, to count the number of icicles on the
on the cross.
Jeannette statue on the cross, and to report back. And it was something that apparently a lot of the midshipmen had to do. So at least, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of the hour that this is a forgotten story, and it very much is. But one place where it's not forgotten is the Naval Academy. They study it, they talk about it, and they revere DeLong as one of their great exploratory heroes. And although they did not reach the North Pole, DeLong and his men did learn a lot about a vast swath of the Arctic that had never been seen before by man. They proved that Wrangel Island was not a continent. It was an island. They discovered three other islands. They took copious and meticulous measurements of the Arctic pack, which are now being studied by NOAA scientists in studying the condition of the ice pack and how it's changed in the last century.
So we can track climate change that way.
Absolutely, yeah. And really one of the very best indicators of change in the Arctic are DeLong's journals and logbooks, because no one else really went to that part of the Arctic. At least at the Navy Academy, it's viewed as a well-remembered and a great success.
Hampton, thank you very much for being with us on Midday.
My pleasure. Yep. This has been fun.
Hampton Sides, award-winning editor of Outside, and author now of this book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette Doubleday's, his publisher. Thank you again, Hampton.
My pleasure.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our Midday for today. And thanks to Rosina Gourmet for providing lunch to our guests. Since 1999, Rosina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items, located in Canton, downtown Baltimore, and Harbor East.